I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Once Iraq's newly elected politicians find their way to Baghdad, they'll face an onerous task. They're going to be asked to form a more perfect union, establish justice, and ensure domestic tranquility, as well as get to work on common defense, the general welfare, and securing the blessings of liberty. In short, they have to write a constitution. The questions are simple and staggering at the same time, and we'd like to hear from you on these as well. Can Iraqis draft a document that guarantees minority rights and still finds the words to describe a unified country? What about the disgruntled Sunnis squeezed out in this last election and pushed from their position of preeminence? Will they find comfort in the protection of a new constitution? Okay, what about the Kurds, the Shia? Will they stay or demand their own independence? And even before all that starts, it's worth asking, can any group of people draft an essential contract of common purpose when there are more than 150,000 foreign soldiers camping in the country? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we'll be talking today with Noah Feldman, a legal expert from New York University, who has helped the Iraqis take some of these early constitutional steps. First, though, with the latest from Baghdad, we're going to Anne Barnard. She is one of the Boston Globe's correspondents living and working in Iraq. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. More to the point, tell me the latest from Baghdad. What are you hearing about the counting of the vote?
Well, the counting of the vote is still going on. It's going to be a long and complicated process that will probably take a few more days before we even have preliminary turnout figures or results. But that said, a lot of the political parties had observers at the polls, and the reports coming back from many of them suggest that the main coalition of Shiite Islamist parties has done very well, and in fact, the leaders of that party are claiming that they've won, if not a majority, then at least a large plurality of the seats.
So it's going to take some time before we find out, for example, how many Sunnis might have voted in polls right across the country.
Yes, that's true, although a Western diplomat told reporters today that it appears that in most of the heavily Sunni areas that we think of as the Sunni Triangle, the areas where the violence has been most difficult, the turnout didn't break 50% in any of those places. The fact that it's anywhere near 50% in some of those places, such as Mosul, is actually a pleasant surprise. But there are some areas like Samarra and Ramadi where turnout was very, very low.
Once the politicians do come to Baghdad, Anne, as I said a couple of moments ago, it's time to take a look at actually drafting a constitution. You quoted a U.S. diplomat in one of your stories as saying that it's really no exaggeration to call the work that's ahead of them a revolution. Why does he use that word?
Well, actually, that diplomat was saying not so much about the work ahead of them, but the changes that have already happened in Iraqi society. Unlike in, for instance, Afghanistan, where many of the warlords that held power before the Taliban still hold it, in Iraq, the Sunni and Ba'athist economic class and social class that ran Iraq for the better part of the last century has actually...
Anne, are you there? I think we've lost our connection to Baghdad. We're going to try and pick that up, and we'll get to Anne a little bit later in the program. But I did mention, as I began, that Noah Feldman is with me. He's a constitutional scholar and professor at New York University Law School, currently working as a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. And you've been sort of up to your elbows in this constitution now for much of the last 2 years. Thanks for coming in. Nice to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, there's one question that I wanted you to help me with, and that is, how hard can this really be? If we look back, you know, to 1789, there have been a lot of very complicated countries devising very complicated constitutions over that period of time. Is it really so difficult for the Iraqis to say, well, we can take a little bit from here and a little bit from here and kind of mark, cut, and paste the constitution together that would fit the country?
It's not an impossible task. As you suggest, there are countries with great diversity of interest, diversity of religion, and very contentious issues right at the heart of their decision-making process, as, for example, slavery was for the Americans who went to write the U.S. Constitution, that have made it. On the other hand, there are also lots of countries whose constitutional efforts have not had success. One thinks of Lebanon, for example, which devised a very delicate, balanced constitution, balancing the different ethnic and religious groups in that country. And it lasted a little bit until the country collapsed into a brutal and lengthy civil war That's just one example of a country that faced challenges very similar to those faced by Iraq that did not manage to emerge with a constitutional arrangement that actually preserved order in the country.
You have warned in the past about a rush to democracy. Are you worried that the circumstances of this election and the sort of months-long deadline that they've set themselves to get to work on the final language of a constitution is going to amount to a rush to democracy?
The greatest danger going forward now is that because these elections took place before significant Sunni political participation had been organized, we may see results, I emphasize may because we don't know the final results yet, but we may see results in which the Sunni Arabs in Iraq, the ones who are most sympathetic to the insurgency, have not shown up to vote in significant enough numbers to be represented in the National Assembly. If that happens, then we're going to have a very great challenge ahead of us because it's hard enough to negotiate a constitution among all the elected officials. But if there's a large contingency of the country, large and potentially violent group of people who are not represented, then negotiating a constitution that will draw them in will be extremely difficult, and it will have been made more difficult, not less difficult, by the elections. So although the elections themselves are really an extraordinary thing, anyone who saw the images and heard the stories must realize that this is an extraordinary day for Iraqis, we're still running a real risk that the exclusion of Sunnis from the vote might have negative consequences.
All right, we're going to push that a little bit farther as the hour goes on. Anne Barnard is back on the line from Baghdad. Anne, I wanted to just, if I could, wrap up with you by asking you about the other side, because we're getting more news from places like Najaf and Karbala, where the Shia leadership is responding to the fact that they had so many people turn out in this election. Is there talk that this gives them the right to imagine an Islamic state or a theocracy or some kind of constitution that would give the clerics much more control than we might have otherwise imagined?
Well, that's clearly one of the biggest questions on everyone's mind. In some ways, Shiites are very much looking forward to being able to make decisions about the country, and many are not inclined to go out of their way to accommodate Sunnis who they say did not accommodate them when they were in power. On the other hand, not everyone feels that way, and there's certainly a very vibrant debate inside the Shia community where even within the Shia Islamist community there's quite a lot of disagreement about whether the Quran should be the literal basis for every area of the law or only the basis for certain areas like marriage. So there will be an interesting discussion about that going forward.
And the role of the Sunnis who may not have been well represented in the election, how are the people in Baghdad explaining that away? Are they saying that appointed Sunni leaders can sit in those chairs and that will be adequate? What are you hearing?
Well, the political parties that do well are going to have to be magnanimous and find a way to bring in people into that dialogue. The question is, which people? The Association of Muslim Clerics has often spoken up pretending or claiming to represent Sunnis, and many Sunnis who turned out to vote said we specifically wanted to vote because we wanted to defy the Sunni clerics who were trying to tell us to boycott when, in fact, it was not in our interest. So that's a big dilemma, is how do you bring in a Sunni voice that is a legitimate one, that has some grounding in the diverse communities within the Sunni population.
Anne, I want to thank you for being with us and putting up with those difficult phone lines once again.
No problem. Thank you.
Anne Barnard is a Boston Globe correspondent joining us there live on the line from Baghdad. Back to Noah Feldman here in the studio. It's an interesting point that she raises at the end, and that is the spirit of generosity, measuring that, how the Sunnis and the Kurds and the others who know, sorry, how the Shia and the Kurds, they're more aware than you and I of how the position of the Sunnis has changed, gone from top to bottom. You've been talking to these people for the past 18 months, perhaps even longer than that. Is that spirit of generosity there?
The spirit of self-interest is there because if the Shia and the Kurds don't give some Sunnis, including some Sunnis whom they very much don't like, a voice at the table, they're going to be met with a continued insurgency. So quite apart from the question of whether they magnanimously want to bring about the complete union of Iraq, and some, of course, do feel that way, but many feel otherwise, they really have very little in the way of a choice. And indeed, one of the hardest things that I have found in such conversations is that both Shia and Kurds say, with a great deal of justice, these Sunnis are ex-regime folks. They treated us horribly. They killed our family members. Now you're asking us to go back to the table and to give not just power, but perhaps disproportionate power to these people who are essentially murderers. And on what basis of justice could you possibly be asking us to do that? And to that very pointed question, the only response I have is, we don't want the people who killed your family members to kill your children. We need to bring about some form of stability in the country, and that's going to require talking to people who don't have a moral right to be at the table.
So the people who say, yes, the election was a tremendous achievement, but the drafting of a constitution that will hold this country together may even be a more difficult task. Are they right in your view?
I think it will be a much more difficult task indeed. The election, remarkable as it was, and it was remarkable, I would even say historic, was still a one-day undertaking, logistically complex, that required people to stay off the streets. And some did, but of course there were also many people who died. Mm-hmm. A constitutional negotiation is a long, deeply political process involving strongly held views, involving a public, and it's serious business.
All right, and we're going to involve our public in this conversation about what next for Iraq. The drafting of a constitution is something that will take place as soon as the politicians have their seats at the table, but not all the politicians will be there. That's only one of the problems. What are the other ones? What is it that Iraqis have in common? Maybe we should talk about that when we come back. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Noah Feldman is here with me in the studio. He's a constitutional scholar who has been working directly with Iraqis as they struggle to come up with the language to describe their country. After the election, this now becomes the task that they must face directly rather than dealing with transitional documents that they've had in the past. Noah is also the author of a brand new book. It's called What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building. Some of these issues are discussed in that book. I'm going to go straight to where I ended last time around and ask you that once you set aside or once you acknowledge all those self-interests that you were talking about, what is it that Iraqis have in common? Why should or how can they, you know, find a document that works for all of them?
Ironically, what the Iraqis have most in common is something that no one knew existed when Iraq was formed, and that is the oil. The truth is that the oil, which is spread out around the country in a very inconvenient way, with some of it around the Kirkuk oil field between the Sunni and the Kurdish areas and other of it in the south, sort of puts a lot of pressure on all the different factions to find some power-sharing arrangement that would hold them together as a country, because otherwise there's a real risk that they would fall into a civil war precisely over the oil. So although many Iraqis would like to see the country, specifically Kurdish Iraqis, would like to see their area independent, what they really have in mind is independence with the oil. And that's rather difficult to accomplish without the agreement of Sunnis and Shia. So oil is the great dominant political force in the region which is driving people to try to hold the country together.
Let's bring Peter Galbraith into the conversation. Peter is a former U.S. ambassador to Croatia, was with us last week talking about aspects associated with this prior to the election, and Peter's been a longtime advisor to Kurdish leaders. Peter, you're where, in Sulaymaniyah this morning?
Near Sulaymaniyah in Kolachola, where the Kurdish leaders have been spending the day meeting, discussing the results of the elections, discussing constitutional issues, and planning their next moves.
And what are they saying?
Well, there's a real sense of satisfaction with the outcome of the elections. They feel that the Kurdistan list will get between 25% and 30% of the vote. They see that the Shiite list will end up perhaps close to 50%. And they're hoping they can make a bargain with the Shiites that will simply preserve the de facto independence that they now enjoy, give them control of their own oil, and maintain Kurdistan as something quite separate from the rest of Iraq.
Be a little bit more precise with me, if you would, about what you're talking about when you talk about independence. Are you talking about the kind of autonomy that the Kurds have now underneath the Iraqi flag, where they get their share of oil revenue and in effect wish to be left alone by the rest of the country? Or is the conversation now turning to Kurdistan, a separate and distinct country?
Well, first, there is no Iraqi flag because in most of Kurdistan, the Iraqi flag simply does not fly. Only the Kurdistan flag flies. But what they have in mind is what exists now. They have their own army. The Iraqi army is not allowed to come here. They get a fixed percentage of the central government budget of Iraq's total oil revenues. They spend it without any control or reporting to Baghdad. They control their own international borders. In fact, they are functionally independent, except that there's a single foreign ministry. They don't have a seat at the United Nations, and they use the same money as Iraq. Although, even on the money, they count in a different kind of dinar, even though they use the Iraqi money, and increasingly it's becoming a dollarized economy here. But as to their ultimate goal, all of them want to see an independent Kurdistan, and there is a real sense, both among leaders and certainly among the public, that these elections are an important step on the way to an independent Kurdistan. There was, as I mentioned last week, an informal advisory referendum that took place within the polling precincts on the question of whether people wanted an independent Kurdistan. Almost everybody who voted in the regular election came out. They voted in the referendum. The results haven't been announced, but I've been watching the count, and it's at least 10 or 11 to 1 in favor of independence.
So, Noah Feldman, if the Kurdish leaders came to Baghdad with that sort of image of their role in constitutionally described Iraq, would the other people in the country be willing to accept what Peter's just described?
It very much depends on how it's packaged. Framed as a step along the way to the full independence of Kurdistan, it will meet with intense resistance. In fact, it's the only issue just about that can unite the Shia and the Sunnis, who otherwise are very much at odds with each other. They all are in agreement that Iraq ought to be held together as a single country, and all are very threatened, indeed, by the idea of a Kurdistan that moves from a kind of de facto autonomy, which it has now, while still being part of Iraq and still sharing the oil revenues, to a fully independent country. I think many Shia and Sunni understand that many Kurds want this, but they're worried about its consequences for their country and for its future. And I think we're likely to see, depending on how the Kurds present their claims initially in the National Assembly, a great deal of rather serious and intense debate on this question.
And so, Peter, what should we expect to hear from Kurdish leaders? Are they going to have a sort of preamble which says, we want to be a part of Iraq, and then but, and a list of things after that? What's your expectation?
I think the preamble will simply say that Iraq is a voluntary union of Arabs and Kurds, implicit in that statement, but I doubt if it will be explicit in the Constitution, is the assumption that a voluntary union can be dissolved. Otherwise, I think that they would want some very brief section on Kurdistan that effectively said, in the Kurdistan region, the powers of the central government will be foreign affairs, a currency, maybe one or two other things, and that all other legislative, executive, and executive power in Kurdistan would rest with the Kurdistan regional government. They will certainly insist that they own and manage their own oil, but they probably will be open to arrangements in which the revenues from the oil are at least partially shared with the rest of Iraq, because, in fact, a revenue-sharing arrangement would be to their interest, that there's going to be more oil produced in the south than will be produced in Kurdistan, even on a per capita basis.
Let me just take that to Noah here in the studio. To own and manage the oil will be – those are fighting words to some people in who are not a part of this northern region of Iraq or Kurdistan.
They will be interpreted that way, because to acknowledge ownership in the constitutional document of the Kurds on this oil is to lay the groundwork, exactly as Peter says, for the potential of ultimate secession. And that's just what the Sunnis in the central part of the country think they can't permit. And in fact, I think many Shia actually feel similarly. So I think their position will be that the central government in Baghdad should be formally the owner of all oil, that the Iraqi people collectively should be owners of all the oil, but it can then be divided among the provinces on some sort of a fair basis, with an understanding that perhaps a lot of the actual administration will take place out of Kurdistan. But I think that's going to be a very contentious issue in the constitutional negotiations, and I actually have a real concern that the volatility just over this single issue, just over the question of oil ownership and the status of Kurdistan, could potentially be a breaking issue in the Constitutional Convention.
And Peter, last one for you. The Kurdish militia, the Peshmerga, are they or would they be willing to take up arms to defend their right to say they own the oil?
Well, I think they would. They are prepared to take up arms to prevent the Iraqi army from coming back into Kurdistan or to have the unhappy history that they've had, in not just during Saddam Hussein's time, but for the entire 80 years that Iraq has been a country. The fundamental problem here is when people use the phrase Iraqi people. The Kurds do not feel as though they're Iraqi people. In fact, it's almost an insult to call them Iraqi. And when people in their heart don't want to be part of a country, almost unanimously, in fact, when they have great antipathy toward that country, it's very hard, I think, over the long run to hold that country together. That is the dilemma. I will say, though, on the issue of oil, I'm more optimistic than Noah. I think that there will be a compromise under which Kurdistan can own and manage its oil, in part because the Shiites want the same thing. They would like to own and manage the oil in the south. In fact, some of the Shiite politicians from those southern governorates, Basra, for example, have come forward and put forward this proposal because they know that under their territory lies some of the largest oil reservoirs in the world.
Peter, I want to thank you for being with us.
Great to be with you again.
Peter Galbraith, former U.S. ambassador to Croatia and a longtime advisor to Kurdish leaders, joining us there live on the line from just outside Sulaymaniyah. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have your thoughts on what's happening with the efforts to try and establish a constitution for Iraq. The more we hear about it, the more complicated it sounds. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky for our first call. Sean is on the line. Hi, Sean.
Hello. You've actually dealt with a lot of what I was going to ask, but the first thing I'd like to query about is one of the enduring strengths of at least the U.S. Constitution has been the Bill of Rights, guaranteeing, you know, the majority of the rights of the minority against the majority of 50% plus one.
Right.
And a lot of times when you look at the success of countries that have dealt with that, it's been leadership by individuals like James Madison with our Constitution or Nelson Mandela in South Africa. And my question is there anybody, this is one of two, is there anybody on the Shia side who's willing to voluntarily give up the power because they have the majority and say, we're not going to take the power, we're going to enshrine the fact that you can't shove the majority's will down substantial minorities? Time after time, when you look at the history of many of these democracies that have developed, especially after World War II, mm-hmm. they haven't given it up, and you have insurgencies all over the world simply over this single issue.
There certainly is only one person whose name we hear on a regular basis here in the United States who has the following to do that would be, I think, Noah Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani. But he seems to give mixed messages. Maybe that's just for his own bargaining advantage. But in reference to what Sean's saying about someone who has the capacity and the following and perhaps the interest in a unified Iraq, can he do this?
Ayatollah Sistani has emphasized so far in all of his public pronouncements that democracy means majority rule. And he has so far not been forthcoming about saying that it means majority rule alongside protection for minorities. Now, that may have been because we were before the elections. And Ayatollah Sistani was very concerned for the elections to happen simply to establish as a juridical fact, as will now be established, that Shia actually are the majority in the country. That will now be known. And
we
now
take that for granted, but in fact there is no census. Nothing has established that in any formal way yet, has it?
That's exactly right. The election will be the first time that we'll have actual numbers that correspond to the actual choices of individuals. So that may be why he was reticent about saying it thus far. The challenge for him now, and indeed for the political parties that want to affiliate themselves with him, will be to recognize that you need, in a diverse and multicultural and multi-ethnic society, to have real protection for minorities. Now, I just want to add one word about what kind of protection that should be. Sean mentions a Bill of Rights, and that, of course, is very, very important indeed. But even Madison himself was initially against the idea of a Bill of Rights because he thought that a parchment guarantee, that's what he called it, a piece of paper that guaranteed rights, wouldn't have very much effect if there weren't institutions in place to guarantee protection for those minorities. And he thought that the Senate in the United States was a good example of that sort of an institution. And indeed, in Iraq, there's a real possibility that we will see something like an upper chamber, an unelected upper chamber that gives, or perhaps appointed or perhaps regionally elected, that gives disproportionate power to the minorities in the country. That way they actually have some part of the government to help protect their rights. And that can sometimes be stronger than just having a very beautifully written Bill of Rights, which I'm sure they'll also have.
Is Sean right, though, to draw our attention away from a minute, for a minute, from the engine of that economy, the oil in the country, and the importance of having that, too? This whole question about how much religion is going to be in that constitution. I was hearing somebody not long ago say the best Iraq could hope for is somewhere between what Iran has, which is in effect a theocracy, I think I'm using the word right, and what Turkey has, which is totally secular, that they're going to end up not only geographically but figuratively somewhere in between there?
I think that's exactly right. Look, this is one of the first times that we're going to see a public constitutional debate. In fact, it may be the first time in the Arab world about the question of how Islam and democracy should interact. And the fact that the leading political party here, which is not clear where they will have won a clear majority or plurality, but in any case, they'll be way ahead of everybody else, will be people who call themselves Islamic Democrats. They say that these things fit together, and now they have to do the hard work of showing how they do, in fact, fit together. So some things are for sure. We know there'll be an official religion, and it will be Islam. We know for sure that Islam will be considered a source of legislation, perhaps even the principal source of legislation according to the Constitution. We might see a provision that says that no law may be passed that violates the principles of Islam, interpreted in one way or another. But in a best-case scenario, we would see alongside these things strong guarantees of democracy. We would say that no law could violate the principles of Islam or the principles of democracy, and according to many of these Islamic Democrats, those principles are indeed compatible with each other. So that's going to be a fascinating and widely watched throughout the Arab and Muslim world aspect of this constitutional debate.
I want to get back to our callers, but you said a word right at the very beginning there that I want to come back to, and that is that it's going to be a public debate, because up until this point, your own work with people in Iraq has not necessarily been behind closed doors, but it has not been a formal public parliamentary debate over what the nature of the country will be. Once you get politicians who have constituencies that they represent and you put them on television or however it is, debating their own self-interest, does that make it harder for them to find compromise?
I think it makes it much, much more difficult. The interim constitution or the transitional administrative law was negotiated by people who were not elected. So it did not have a claim to broad democratic legitimacy. It didn't even try to make such a claim. But in that environment, people could compromise. They could say, you know, I can live with this formulation. But now imagine they have to go out and get reelected. And imagine they have to make these agreements on national television, indeed international television, on Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera. Suddenly the positions that they defend can't be compromised positions, at least not in the first realm, because they're going to be second-guessed by the Monday morning constitutional quarterbacks throughout the region and indeed throughout the world. So it's going to make compromise harder, not easier.
Do you think it'll have that kind of attention? Are we talking about something that is that groundbreaking here?
In the Arab world, there has never been anything even vaguely like it. And it is going to have a rapt attention for some of the big set-piece constitutional debates. You will see high ratings throughout the Arab world for these kinds of discussions, simply because of the novelty of the thing. You know, these are not countries in which legislative debate is of any particular interest, because generally the fix is in. These are countries in which public information is of very limited quality, except when it comes from the international networks. They're going to see people debating explicitly, should an Arab country that's mostly Muslim be secular? Should the role of the Kurds be fully independent? Should Islam be the dominant role? Public legitimate debates about this are a unique an original thing, really, and I think that could, in the long run, be of greater historical importance than anything else that happens in this next process.
All right, Connection listeners, there is a little bit of a preview of what is ahead for Iraqis, but also for the rest of us in terms of establishing some of the ideas that President Bush talked about when he talked about spreading freedom around the world, and whether or not it is actually going to happen in the language and the debate of a constitution. Can a country that has so many things dividing its people find the paperwork and the goodwill to draft a constitution to keep them together? We're going to hear from you when we come back after the break. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Well, the practical application of democracy, of Iraqis actually coming to terms with what their country is going to be, is now upon them. Once the newly elected transitional government is put in place, their task is to set to work on a constitution. Can they do something? Can they actually stitch the country together with the all the divisions that exist, and with over 150,000 U.S. soldiers and people from other countries armed and living in their country? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Noah Feldman is here with me. He's written a book called What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building. He's a constitutional scholar who's been involved in giving advice to people there about what will work and what won't. We're going to Waltham, Massachusetts for our next call. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Dick. Mine is a question and a comment.
Yeah.
The comment is, I come from the same country with a background like Iraq. We had war. That's Uganda.
Okay.
And there was a lot of war, and some people who are in government right now came up with an idea as to make a constitution, and they elected delegates from all around the country to make this constitution. But because these people were already in power, they used their power to put their own people in the Constitution Commission, and they made a constitution that favors them to keep them in power. So I foresee this happening in Iraq once the U.S. leave. That's why I feel like the U.S., I think, shouldn't leave until these people make the constitution. Otherwise, the people who are elected now are going to use their own people to make a constitution that is going to fit their own agenda.
Michael, let me interrupt you and ask you a question, if I can. Because the people in power chose their own constitutional drafters in Uganda, does that mean that the people then don't pay any attention to the Constitution? They don't believe in it, or they don't think it's legitimate?
Okay, they have come to settle with the Constitution, but unfortunately it is favoring a few people in power. They keep manipulating the Constitution to keep themselves in power. The president has been in power for 20 years, and he's still be in power because he's changing the constitution around. How can we do this so that it doesn't happen in Iraq?
Noah.
Michael, you're raising really the core question of all constitutional processes. How do you stop the people who are in charge of writing it from just putting themselves in power and keeping themselves there? Because if they do, the constitution could be formally in place, but it doesn't mean very much because it doesn't ensure democratic processes. In Iraq, the danger is that the Shia and the Kurds, who will have won in these elections, might reach an agreement that favors them while marginalizing the Sunnis. The Shia and the Kurds need each other because they both did well in these elections. The short answer to that is that the fact of the insurgency, ironically, is the one thing that's going to keep the Shia and the Kurds honest. They need to end the insurgency. To do that, they have to give a role to Sunnis in the process. They have to bring the Sunnis into the process. What they will then get is a power-sharing constitution. And when you have a power-sharing constitution, it makes it much harder for a small group of people to continue to dominate over the very long term, because those groups that are represented represent a broad cross-section of the society.
Are you saying to Michael, though, that the insurgency is almost certain to continue because it's the only stick the Sunnis have at this point to make their presence known in the country?
Some of the Sunnis are engaged in the insurgency because they're trying to raise the price of entering into a final pact agreement. Other Sunnis are ideologically committed to a jihad against the U.S. as occupier and perhaps against the Shia and the Kurds as well. Those jihadis may never stop their insurgent fighting, but they can only be beaten if enough Sunnis enter into the negotiating process, the political process, and decide that they want the future of the country not to be civil war.
Let's go to Boston next, and AK is joining us from Boston. Hi, AK.
Good morning. Good morning to you, Dick. Good program and to your guest. My only comment is that I noticed your guest is talking about the new constitution be something between Iran and Turkey. And me as an Iranian just want to tell you that this is a very dangerous precedent the guest is talking about. If the basis of this legislation for Iraq is going to be the rules of Islam, it is extremely dangerous. There is no democracy in that religion. There is none, and there will never be any religious. If the rules are going to be interpreted by what the Quran says, then might as well just U.S. hand the whole situation over to the insurgency, say, all right, guys, you can have something like Iran. But U.S. knew what the situation is over there, and they cannot give in to this insurgency.
AK, I thought there were some examples, not very good examples, but some examples of Islamic republics that try to work within a democratic framework. That's the way Pakistan was set up, and you can look back over the last 55 years and say, okay, it hasn't really worked very well, but the attempt is there. Are you saying that it's a lost cause to begin with?
It's a lost cause. Me as an Iranian, I travel to that country every year. There is no way that there is a democracy in that religion. It's two opposite sides. The religion cannot provide any democracy. Any rule that says that its basis is the Islam. Islam says no drinking. Islam says the woman this. The woman has got to cover themselves. You know, the woman is a second-hand citizen. They cannot, if they have to go by the Western rule, then all the whole basis of this this religion
Okay, I get your point. I want to hear from Noah on this, you know, on those obvious questions about human rights and equality.
If democracy and equal rights were purely Western phenomena and Islam were entirely inflexible and mired in previous centuries, then I think you might be right. But I actually don't think that either of those things is true. I think that democratic principles can work all over the world and indeed have. A country like India is profoundly democratic. That's got its own problems without any doubt. And many Muslims believe, including, most importantly, Ayatollah Sistani and those who are following him, that in fact Islam does not require the state to preclude, for example, equality for women. Not only did women vote in this election, but one-third of the candidates for office, by law, had to be women. And in fact, one-third of the people in this National Assembly are going to be women. That's a lot higher number than we have, for example, in the United States, in our House and Senate. Indeed, I think it's more than we even have in our state legislatures on average. So we're talking about a process whereby Muslims have come to believe, some Muslims at least, have come to believe that the Iranian model does not work. And Ayatollah Sistani understands that that model has failed. And indeed, the politicians running for office in Iraq on an Islamic slate said, we do not want the Iranian model. But at the same time, they do believe that their version of Islam is compatible with equality for women, is compatible with equality for non-Muslims.
If I try to get my North American head around this, are you talking about a separation of church and state where laws are managed in secular courts and they don't contradict Islam, but people worship where they want to worship, and that's not a part of the constitutional of the government structure?
There will be religious liberty in Iraq. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The interim constitution was very clear about this, and I believe that the Islamic Democrats are prepared to say that people can worship how they want and where they want. On the other hand, we are also not talking about separation of church and state on the American model and certainly not on the Turkish model. The state will support and pay for mosques, almost undoubtedly. Islam will be taught in the schools. Some issues, for example, this may be the case, marriage and divorce may end up being regulated by religious law, the religious law of whichever religion you happen to belong to. These are things that are controversial. Some Iraqis want them, others do not want them. But I don't believe that they are fundamentally incompatible with democracy. One thinks of Israel, which is, by most accounts at least, a democracy in which marriage and divorce are regulated by religious law. A lot of people don't like it in Israel and outside, but I don't think it makes Israel not a democracy.
1-800-423-8255 to Nashville, Tennessee next. And Gary's joining us. Gary, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks a lot. Am I correct in my observation that Iraq is going to move to a proportional representation system, a parliamentary system? Is that correct?
Gary, the elections that just happened did follow a parliamentary proportional representation system, just as
okay.
You say, but there's no guarantee that the new constitutional convention will choose that going forward. They may well change their plans. The reason this was adopted now was that there were no reliable census numbers, so dividing districts fairly was essentially impossible. Furthermore, the Kurds don't even agree with the districts that Saddam drew in the first place, so districting at all was a non-starter. That's why they used the technique this time, but they could change that.
Yeah. Is it a little ironic in the sense that our system, this winner-take-all, might lead to a system that is disproportional? I mean, the fact that here, of course, certain groups, Greens, Libertarians, essentially kind of get left out.
The general conventional wisdom is that if you have an election like ours, a winner-take-all district-by-district election system, that tends to drive politicians towards the center. That is to say, it drives the winning politicians towards the center because each politician needs to win the swing vote in the middle. By contrast, in a proportional representation system, you might have Greens or Libertarians or any parties that are perceived as being at the extremes of the political spectrum. They might get enough votes nationwide to get a few seats in office. Israel uses this technique, and a lot of people think it leads to the polarization of their political system. So each of these systems has its advocates.
It's probably fair to say, though, just taking the last point that Gary made, that the country, any country like Iraq, trying to set up a democratic form of governance isn't going to go with a two-party system, that there will be, assuming it works, more than two parties, perhaps more than five or six parties, the next time these people get a chance to vote?
I think that's almost certainly going to be the case. The question is whether over time, if they were to adopt a district-by-district winner-take-all system, they might move in the direction of two parties. I suspect they wouldn't, if only because the Kurds and the Shias don't see things exactly eye to eye, and Sunnis have their own independent interests.
All right, back to our lines to Boston, and Lokman's with us. Hi, Lokman.
Hi, Dick. Good morning, Professor Noah. Good to hear from you. I have to disagree with Professor Noah regarding the constitution, because there were constitutions in place in the previous regimes of Iraq, but it didn't work because it doesn't work in Iraq because there are two nationalities, they have two different visions, two different ideology. They cannot live together. That's the problem here. And a small example for that, just the TAL, Transitional Administration Law, Chapter 58, there was something to be done about that. During the 7 months, the Arabs did not let this happen. So we don't have, as the court, we don't have faith in the in that constitution. And the experience of the last 83 years of brutality and cruelty makes the Kurds doesn't feel like Iraqi. And
look, man, you're speaking for the Kurds, are you?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to clear that up.
Yes, I'm a very proud representative of more than 1.7 million signatures referendum for independence for Kurdistan.
So you would never call yourself an Iraqi?
I don't feel like an Iraqi, sir. Well, I just don't feel it because when I see the government, the ruler, plans to Arabize my cities, when I see the government kills and murders, genocides civilian people, innocent children, I cannot have faith in that government.
Yeah, no, I get you. There is no arguing with the history, and this is going to be a huge part of the negotiations and the conversation ahead, is it not, Noah?
Sir, you're exactly right. I think that your view probably represents that of many, many people in Kurdistan for whom historically Kurdistan has never been proudly part of Iraq because it's always been mistreated and much worse, as you say. On the other hand, when the transitional law was signed, Masoud Barzani, the head of the KDP, the Kurdish Democratic Party, said, "For the first time in my life, I feel proud to be an Iraqi." And I believe that what he meant was that if there were to be an Iraq in which Kurdistan was an official language, Kurdish was an official language alongside Arabic, in which Kurds had significant power in the central government in Baghdad, in which, in addition to that, Kurds had substantial autonomy in their region, then over time, Kurds might come to see that there are some benefits to being part of Iraq, and they might come to see themselves as part of a new kind of Iraq, a federal Iraq, with greater openness and greater possibilities. Now, I'm not saying that that's certain to work. It may fail. And if it does fail, then there will be a movement for greater independence, as indeed in the referendums there already has been. But I think that there is at least a chance of a transformation of Iraq into something new. And most importantly, the reason I favor that is not that I'm devoted in some absolute sense to the unity of Iraq. It's just that I don't see how we can get to an independent Kurdistan right now without violence. And I'm trying to avoid that kind of violence.
Lokman?
I agree with Professor Noah, but whatever you try and however you try, it is very hard to make people who cannot live together. You have a family, just in a family, the wife and the husband been for together, living together for 15 years, and their marriage was based on love, yet they separate. So why not separating Kurdistan from this so-called Iraq, which proved to be a failure?
Look, man, if you forgive me, there's one more point that I want to hear from Noah on before the end of the program, and it's not directly connected to the Kurds, but it has to do with what the role of the United States is now, because this time last year, when Paul Bremer was still head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, and there was all this jockeying to get people together to try and put together a transitional constitution, it was pretty clear at that time that the U.S. had a strong hidden hand in forcing people to the table. Now, I don't know how that changes, how this past weekend's election alters the influence of the United States. If things start to spin out of control, does the U.S. have the ability to say, get back to the table.
You know, last time it was absolutely a central feature because the U.S. was able to say, look, you're going to do a deal. And the proof that this was successful is that at the end of the process, Kurds were very unhappy with the deal they got, and Arabs were very unhappy with the deal that they got. And that's always a sign of a successful outcome in a negotiation. If one side is happy, you know something's wrong. This time around, there will still be U.S. troops on the ground. There will still be the same number of U.S. troops on the ground, more than 140,000. And so the U.S. will inevitably have some role to play because it can always say, look, if you don't reach this agreement, our own interest in remaining in Iraq may wane and we may be interested in withdrawing, which is something that no one wants in Iraq just now. They want us to leave eventually, but they don't want to leave us to leave until things are much more stabilized. On the other hand, the direct personal intervention of a U.S. ambassador would be, I think, almost unimaginable under the public conditions of this constitutional negotiation, because Iraqis and Kurds are very proud, they are very independently minded, they have elected these representatives, and they want those representatives to make those decisions on their own behalf. So the U.S. will have a view, it will have a role, but nothing like the kind of role that it had last time. That's as it should be from a democratic perspective, because this is going to be a democratic constitutional process, but it's going to make it that much harder to reach an agreement. In the end, the fear on the part of Iraqis, Kurdish or otherwise, for failing will not come from the anger of the U.S. It will come from the anger of the Iraqi people. It will come from the danger that Iraq might collapse if, in fact, no constitution is reached. So that's going to be the driving incentive force to reach an agreement. And I hope and trust that an agreement can be reached despite the difficulties.
But it's still going to be something very delicate to try and manage, because if, in fact, things do start to unravel and there is more violence, then those 140,000 American soldiers who are there are going to get involved again, and we'll be back in the same sort of horrible position we've been for the past 2 years with the Iraqis. Most of them are saying, we don't want the Americans here, but we want the Americans here.
The U.S. has a huge interest for that reason in making sure that a deal is reached. But the truth is that in the end, our interest, though great, can never be as great as that of the Iraqis themselves.
Right.
They're the ones who actually have to live in this country, not today, not tomorrow, but for the next 50 years, 100 years, for the next centuries. So they need to reach an agreement, although we also very much want them to do so, in part because all of us want the same thing in the end, which is the withdrawal of U.S. troops.
Well, we're going to follow it, and I hope we get a chance to talk again with you. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Noah Feldman is a professor at the New York University Law School and author of What We Owe Iraq. He's currently working as a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. Earlier in the program, we talked with Anne Barnard. She's a Boston Globe Baghdad correspondent. Peter Galbraith was also with us. He's a longtime advisor to Kurdish leaders, a former U.S. ambassador. The Connection is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.